Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Swing and a fly ball back in left field, and this ball is gone, a home run for McCann. A three-run shot to left center field into the stands behind the left field bullpen, and the Tigers lead the Blue Jays 3-0 in the second. Here's the pitch from Happ, swing and a fly ball to right field, and this one is off the top of the wall. Upton hangs on. Martinez being waved home for Detroit, and he scores, and the Tigers get another one. And now they're saying it's a home run. Here's Hardy delivering now, and Tolley swings and grounds it to second. It's picked up and thrown to Romine, and the game is over. The Tigers with an 11-0 shutout over the Toronto Blue Jays on this Monday night, and four in a row now for Detroit.
Trying to win a season-high six straight games, taking on the Mariners. No score in the third, a man on for Nori Aoki. He delivers an RBI single off Trevor Bauer. A run scores, the M's take a 1-0 lead. In the fourth, a man on, Jose Ramirez rips one into left off James Paxton. Carlos Santana trying to score from first. He's in there as Chris Iannetta can't hang on to it. We're tied at one. Now 2-1, bottom half of the fourth, Bauer settling in. Strikes out Robinson Cano, then down goes Nelson Cruz. Then with two on and two outs, he strikes out Chris Iannetta to end the frame. In the fifth, the Indians add to their lead. Rajay Davis provides some breathing room. A solo shot, number six on the year. 3-1 Cleveland. The Indians go on and win it by a final of 3-1 for a season-high sixth straight win.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
There, well, that's what I was waiting for. I wasn't quite sure. I'm always told that I'm right by Jim Cushlin as we get started on the extravaganza. What's going on? Thanks so much for joining us. An outstanding Tuesday to you. Thanks for spending the time with us. Jim, when's the last time we led the show with a montage of baseball highlights?
It's been a little bit.
God. I mean, I'm not kidding. Ever since the NBA playoffs started, I don't think it's been unanimous 100% of the time we'll do a montage of NBA stuff, but this huge, vast majority of them have been, of course, because the Cavaliers played the Pistons in the first rounds. We had tons of montages and highlights after that, you know, during that sweep. Then the Cavaliers moving on, of course, so they led the conversation almost every other day because of the nature of the challenge, chasing a championship and so on. But very few and in far in between have we had anything else since that time. And now here we are, two games from the end of the NBA season, two games potentially from a sweep at the hands of the Warriors. And we went away from a basketball open today. Yesterday, of course, we started with a boxing open, the tribute to the great Muhammad Ali. No, there was no thought given, by the way, as we get started this afternoon, to doing a tribute to Kimbo Slice today in a similar way. Those are two different things. Both sad, obviously, and in the case of Kimbo Slice, the internet sensation, the backyard street brawler who made a name for himself and, in fact, got so famous that he worked his way into the MMA for a little bit. Didn't really do well there when you're against professional fighters and not other street bums. You have to be conditioned and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, Kimbo Slice, beloved member of the Bellator MMA family, dying at the age of 42 yesterday. Just kind of odd that this fighting, you know, character of his that he created passes away just a few days. In fact, 3 days past Muhammad Ali. And it's just an odd... I guess comparison there. One is considered the greatest of all time, and the other one, of course, just known for his internet videos mostly. But according to those who knew him, and I have no clue, never saw any real interviews of any depth with him, he was a gentle giant. They say he was a very, very good man, a devoted family man, and right now there's no explanation for his death. And that's the very sad part about it. So at any rate, that was the little side story there, just to kind of get a little off track to start. We have a lot of things to talk about today. Don't think we won't talk about the NBA because the Cavs and Warriors have another off day today. They don't play Game 3 until tomorrow. We will, but it's going to be a little different than the X's and O's and everything else. We are going to talk a little baseball coming up at 4:05. We'll talk about the first place Cleveland Indians with Zach Meisel from Cleveland. We will also talk about the Tigers, not with anybody until tomorrow, when our good friend Anthony Fennick, who covers the Tigers for the Detroit Free Press, will join us. But we do have some Tigers news for you, too. A couple of interesting notes from our friend Aaron McMahon at MLive.com. The assault on left-handed pitching continues against Toronto, and that 11-0 win, you just heard some highlights from there, knocking J.A. Happ out of the game. Certainly something to talk about. Tigers are over 500, Jim. There's room for celebration, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the reason I went with the baseball.
You got to get a little closer there, brother. I'm sorry. You got to get a little closer.
And that's part of the reason I went with some of the baseballs. I'm trying to think, what should I put in today? Because you got that extra off day for travel for the NBA. And we did Ali and stuff yesterday. It's like, you got the Indians. They've won six in a row. They now have a 2.5-game lead. So basically 3 days worth of a lead in the Central. And for the first time seemingly in forever this season, the Tigers are over 500. Remember, it wasn't too long ago that we were talking when they were losing, what was it, seven in a row, and is this the end of the line for Brad Ausmus? That talk is somewhat subsided when that happens when you win.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's when that talk happened, really, you know, when people got, they were on Ausmus' watch, you know, at what point was the trigger going to be pulled, so to speak. It's when, you know, and no small amount of credit, I don't think, Jim, goes to Victor Martinez for kind of publicly calling everybody out on this and saying, lay off him, lay off our manager.
Right.
If we screw up, it's us on the field screwing up. We're missing the ball. We're not making the right pitch. We're doing this, doing that. This is not
the right
thing.
He
got very angry about the calls for the firing of Ausmus from some in the media and from some at Comerica, some of the fans, maybe message boards, blogs, social media, et cetera. But that kind of started a little bit of a fire, maybe under the team. They rallied around Brad Ausmus to say, "Ha, you're not breaking it up. You're not getting rid of our manager." And ever since that time, obviously they've played much better baseball. I mean, we're not talking world beaters here. The Tigers are 5-5 in their last 10, but they have won their last 4, and this is what they've become as team streak, and now creeping over. And here's the crazy part: despite all of the up and down and the near firing of the manager and that sort of thing, it's a very, very tightly packed division. First place through fourth place, separated only by 3.5 games. And that's where they sit, you know, tied for third, technically, 3.5 back.
Right. And as I've been wording it on and off the air in the last about week or two or so, you know, because we're past Memorial Day, way past 40 games, so standings can mean something now. Really, unless your name is the Minnesota Twins, you're in this race in the American League Central. I mean, because you got Kansas City. We mentioned the Indians, mentioned the Tigers. And then there's the White Sox, who started off so well, not doing as well recently, but they did just acquire James Shields to help strengthen their rotation. And that's interesting that a trade like that has already been made this early. It's still only early June.
Well, it's early for everybody else except for a team like the Padres,
who are 24-35,
and they know they're not going to be buyers. They know, you know, if there's an opportunity to improve their roster now, and there's a right trade out there, they're going to make it. They got to dump salary, which, of course, Shields is a big part of, in addition to getting some prospects to restock. So the Padres are, of course, well out of it. I mean, not as bad as some others. The Reds are, what, 19.5 back in the Central of the National League, 18 for the Braves, 16 for those Twins that you mentioned, and then 11 for the Padres. But at any rate, it's not too early to sell for them. And yeah, to the point about the Central Division, it is going to be a very interesting race. I said this to who did we talk to last week about baseball? I can't remember, but it wasn't Fennick because Anthony wasn't available. Anyway, it's going to be nip and tuck, I said, and I believe it's going to be nip and tuck all summer long. I said then, and I believe now, that the Kansas City Royals are not, just because they're the defending champions, they are not head and shoulders above the Indians or the Tigers or the White Sox, for that matter, so much so that they're going to go on this extended run and put double digits between themselves and second place. It's not going to happen.
Right.
I said this when they were up by, I think, 2.5 games. Now, of course, they go on a 5-game losing streak, 4 of which were to the Indians, who are now, because of that, on a six-game winning streak, and suddenly the Royals are down 2.5 games to the Tribe, red hot, 7-3 out of their last 10, six in a row, as I mentioned, getting great pitching, getting power when they needed, and timely hitting, even despite the losses of Michael Brantley, a Silver Slugger, one of the best hitters in the American League, if not baseball, and the career-ending suspension, if you will, of Marlon Byrd. They brought some young guys up like Tyler Naquin who can rake. And so it's interesting. I don't think anybody, the Indians aren't running away with this. The Royals aren't running away with this. The Tigers, you know, they can get there. They can get to the top and be part
of
the
sweep and
tuck
thing,
but they're not running away with this. And neither are the White Sox, who started to run away with this in the first month and a half of the season. I think it's going to be even all the way through.
And as do I, the way it's going. All these teams have their strengths. They all have their weaknesses. And, you know, at the same time, this is where that playing in the division, you know, it's so weighed heavily in baseball, more so than the other various sports. And I look at that, and it's a situation where the Indians have done very well against the Central. They're 18-7 right now against Central. They're undefeated against the Tigers. They just swept the Royals in four. And in one of those odd quirks of baseball, the only team in the division the Indians can't seem to beat is the Minnesota Twins.
Yeah, that is one of those weird things. I don't think that'll last, obviously. I think when they get together, I mean, the Twins are 16-40. I mean, they are literally, are they the worst team in baseball? 286 winning percentage? No. That goes to the Braves, who are 281. So they are the second worst team baseball, or winning percentage-wise, in baseball. And there you have it. So, I mean, that'll turn around for the Indians if they continue to play this way. So, anyway, we're going to do a little baseball today. We want you to be a part of our program at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. 1065. You can also tweet to us, or you can Facebook comment to us as well. Our Twitter feed is Sports Radio 1065. Please give us a follow there on our Twitter feed. And then Facebook, it's 1065 The Ticket. We would love to read the best tweets on the stories of the day on the air if you can't wait on hold to talk to us. Of course, we certainly would love to talk to you first and foremost. Get a lot of people that listen to the show who really just, and they say it, they call us, they'll email us and say, love listening to you guys, but they're passive listeners, and that's fine. We love passive listeners in that we love people listening. If we're doing something that makes you stop what you're doing and listen to us, and you got a ton of choices to flip around on a dial and you're listening to us, that's awesome. We appreciate it. But we also want some active listeners too. So if you've got something to say, we are certainly ready and willing to listen in addition to laying it all out for you.
Absolutely. I've always liked treating at least part of this as an open forum for you guys.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. Whether it's about the finals, whether it's about baseball and the Tigers that we just laid out, or the Indians, whatever the case might be. And sometimes a little bit off the grid, if you will, or however you want to phrase that, because they're or off the board, there's a number of stories that I would like to talk about today that are not pleasant to talk about. But I really feel like I want to say something about them. I'm speaking specifically about that Stanford swimmer who was convicted by a judge of raping an unconscious girl behind a dumpster after a party, and who was given basically an affluenza-like sentence. And if you don't know what that means, it's a news story from Texas from about 2-3 years ago now, a young punk teenage kid who got hammered and got into his family's SUV and killed four people, ran them down, got no jail time, zero, in large part because of what a lot of doctors determined, and they had an expert testify as affluenza. That word taken from influenza, which is an illness, obviously, and affluence, meaning being wealthy. This young punk kid from Texas was so wealthy, his parents gave him anything he ever wanted, never taught him right from wrong, never taught him good from bad, and so therefore he wasn't criminally responsible for his terrible decision-making when he killed four people. So he never got a day in jail, and it's been blamed in large part through the years on affluenza. Well, there is a, I got to watch my mouth, there is a swimmer at Stanford University whose name is Brock Turner, convicted of sexual assault of an unconscious girl, who got 6 months, for what could have been years, in large part because of a father asking the court for leniency because his growing, budding superstar of a son has such great, bright things in front of him, and quite, end quote, it's a steep price to pay for 20 minutes of action out of his 20-plus years of life, end quote. It is outraging. So many in the legal community, women's rights groups, and quite frankly, me, I read the story yesterday in a couple of different places. I read the father's entire letter, and then I read the letter written by the victim that she wrote to the defendant and read aloud to him in the courtroom about how her life has been impacted by this thing. Mike Golic went off on this today. I read this yesterday. I wasn't sure how many sports shows would touch it because it's not about the sport of swimming at Stanford. It's about an athlete and crime. I'm glad to know they are touching it. It's kind of like when we talked about Greg Hardy. Greg Hardy, the convicted domestic abuser in North Carolina who was suspended by the NFL, then had his suspension reduced to 4 games and was picked up by the Cowboys. You know, we need to talk about athletes and their accountability. I was really glad to see. I didn't know how many shows would do it. But Golic did it this morning on Mike and Mike, which I never mind telling you, you hear each and every day right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. But Golic went off on the father and the judge, because the judge basically did the same thing as the Affluenza, Texas case. The judge basically said, yeah, prison might be really, really hard on this guy because, you know, he's led a different kind of a life. In other words, he's young and healthy and pretty, and he doesn't need to go into prison for a long time. We'll just give him 6 months in jail. It's sickening. And I can tell you, this is the father of a daughter, and I know anybody else who is a father of a daughter, had this been our daughters, well, you know the rest of the story. So we're going to play that Golic rant for you. He really went off, and I want to talk about it myself a little bit. So that's on the table today. Also, some things that we want to talk about. Back to the NBA, but this, Jim, is not about the NBA Finals. Two stories, actually, that I wanted to hit. One about the team that is currently leading the Finals 2-0. Another old guard player is coming up with the get-off-of-my-lawn argument. And you know what I'm talking about. Scottie Pippen said about, 6 weeks ago when he was asked that his Bulls would have swept the current Golden State Warriors in a in a championship series. It wouldn't have gone seven. He says they would have swept them. We know that Isaiah Thomas and Oscar Robertson, among others, have questioned whether Steph Curry could play the way he plays today, back in the olden days, if you will. Now it's Magic Johnson's turn. Magic said his Showtime Lakers, that included, of course, Magic Johnson, as well as Byron Scott, as well as James Worthy, as well as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Michael Thompson, who, of course, is Clay's father, who else was on that team, Rambis, that he said, basically, we would have taken down the Warriors. So once again, the old stars calling out. Oh, and I almost forgot about Tracy McGrady. Tracy McGrady, who, of course, was the former Magic All-Star and Rocket All-Star, who called out Steph Curry for being the first unanimous winner of the MVP award, saying it's a watered-down league now. He won unanimous decision in a watered-down league. So a lot of the old guard stepping up and smacking down today's younger NBA and the way the game perhaps is played today. So I want to get into that a little bit. And then also, this is one that I find very, very interesting, given the fact that we are not yet done with the finals. And yes, Steph Curry has announced he will not be playing for the U.S. Olympic team. He's pulling himself out because of injuries that he has suffered that he knows he's going to need to take some time to rehab and repair. LeBron James, whose body, of course, has been put through many, many minutes in his 13 years, because he's gone to the finals in each of the last six. So tons of playoff games, tons of finals games added on to the regular season. LeBron says he will not talk about playing internationally until this series is over. But it has prompted a really, really long and in-depth discussion, if you will, on ESPN.com about whether or not the NBA's season is too long. Do they need to start shortening the games? Because when you have, not the actual 48 minutes, but the number of games, because the number of games is leading to far too many players, in the estimation of those who have said this, putting their body through things their bodies can't handle. And even if they can handle them in the short term, the injuries start to add up in the long term because of the degenerative nature of running 82 games a year plus preseason, plus teams that go to the postseason every year. You know, what are we talking about, 100 games a year mostly?
Yeah, for a finals team, you're definitely up in that ballpark for a team that makes the finals, and if you include preseason.
How many preseason games do they play in?
About 10. Because
about
I did
10.
Read
the Stars don't play a ton of minutes in those.
Though. Right, but I did read preseason games in the NBA. It really roughly breaks out to about 1/8 of the schedule, so it's about 10 games.
Okay, but like I said, that's, you know, we can't say that the Stars
right.
are playing a ton of those, but obviously in the playoffs they are. So, you know, whatever you throw it at, you know, if an average team, you know, makes a run into the playoffs that is 4 or 8 games long, if you get into a second series, and maybe 12 or 13 long, if you say, you know, if you say 2 series that go 6 games, 12 there, 8 to 10 you mentioned in preseason, that's 20 on top of the 82, so we're talking about maybe 100 games a year for some of these guys.
Yep.
And maybe more for guys like LeBron who keep going to the finals.
Sure.
Anyway, the question was, is should the league shorten the season? And would the owners be willing to do to shorten the season? See, here's the thing. Here's the conundrum for the owners. And, quite frankly, for their partners, the television networks. Would they be willing to shorten the season, thereby costing themselves revenue up front, you know, right at the start? Because if you say you shorten the game from 82 to 75, or all the way down to 72, and I don't know what number they're talking about.
By the way, and I would just calculate one thing to throw in there, a number, Bob. If you just played, because there's 30 teams, right? So if you're, say, the Cavs, that's 29 opponents in terms of the rest of the NBA. You play them once in each building, that's 58 games. Just throwing that out there, that feels like in any of this discussion, that would be the floor. You'd want everybody to still play everybody if you could, to do it once in their building, once in the other. That's 58 games.
And obviously, you're going to play everybody in your division at least 3 times. So add that on now to another, 5 other teams in your division. So that's
4 opponents.
I'm sorry?
That would be 4 opponents in your division.
4 opponents in your division that you want to play 3 times each. That's 12 games. There's no way they're going to go anything less than 70, I think it's fair to say, just based on what I just described. Maybe 74, 75, I don't know. But the point being, would the owners and would the networks be willing to give up revenue generated from ad sales, et cetera?
We all know the answer to this question,
eight
though.
To 10. Well, no. Wait till you don't know that. You don't know because you don't know the second part of it. Obviously, the first answer is, would they give up revenue? No. But if they saw the big picture and realized that the revenue generated from the long term would far exceed what you're giving up in the short term in those games, what I mean by that is, if they can shorten the seasons and extend the playing careers of LeBron James and Kevin Durant and Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, knowing you're going to have those stars for maybe, you know, 15 years instead of when they can't make it and they can't walk or run like they used to after 11 or 12, or the back goes bad, or the knees are degenerated to the point where they can't jump like they used to. If you know you can get these players to play for, you know, a few more seasons, and they are your star attractions that draw the crowds anyway, there's a conversation to be had there. Sure, you lose the money up front in shortening the season, but you may make it all back and then some if indeed you can extend the careers of some of these stars, and that's what they're talking about. And by the way, no less than Kobe Bryant, who just retired after 20 years, thinks that the season is too long. There are a lot of players today who are willing to say, the season is too long. It is causing wear and tear on the body that we cannot, you know, possibly counteract no matter how hard we train, no matter how good the medical technology, the equipment, the knowledge, surgeries, doesn't matter. At some point, it's just too much for the human body to endure. Now, I can already hear some of the really, you know, angry guys, you know, you're making $26 million a year on a max contract. You'll play 100 games if that's what we tell you to play. And the answer, of course, is that's true. They are making that money, the max guys. And even what's the league minimum or what's the league average, I wonder? salary right now. Obviously, it changes year to year. But it's true, they would play 100 games if that's what the league said. We're going to move to 100 game schedule. They'll still play it. They'll still get their money. But they're saying we won't be able to play it for as many years. And we're going to have to also take other shortcuts in order to make sure that our bodies are healthy enough to play for as long as we possibly can. Steph Curry, again, is kind of the focal point, at least at the start of this this discussion in this piece, because his body broke down again for the second time in 8 days. And this is a problem. This is, you know, after weeks of speculation, his body broke down twice in 8 days. And this was the sprained MCL on the right leg that forced him to win or to miss a number of days. And certainly in the playoffs, I think he missed 5 games, considering the end of the first series and the start of the conference semifinal series. But at any rate, he's not the only one. LeBron, as I mentioned, has said he's really going to hold off on deciding whether he'll join Team USA until he sees how his body feels after the finals. All-stars like LaMarcus Aldridge, Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, Anthony Davis, John Wall, they're also injury-related Olympic scratches. So they're not going to play because of injuries. And there's others who maybe aren't injured who just say, look, my body needs the rest. My body can't continue this. I'd love to get a gold medal. I'd love to represent America, but come on. Look at what they're doing to us. Entering these finals, throw these numbers at you just for the sake of the conversation. Entering these finals, rotation players, meaning the top 7 players on each team in minutes per game, that's what's considered your 7-man rotation, have missed 61 playoff games in 2016 alone. That is the highest total in the last 2 decades. And it's triple the amount of games that were missed from 1996 to 1999. So in the last 2 decades, the last 20 years to 96, it's the highest total ever, when it's triple in the 3 years previous. In the last 5 postseasons, 217 games were lost to injury. That's 105 more than the total of the previous 5 postseasons from 2007 to 2011. So player health or player, lack of player health is what is dictating the conversation, and it has a lot of people saying that maybe it's time to start to scale this back a little bit, that maybe we just can't go 82 games, you know, all out, and then a full playoff or a series or a playoff run in which you have 3 series to even make the finals. Then you got to win the finals.
And of course, all the playoff series are best of 7 now. The one of the arguments you hear thrown out there is make the first round best of 5 like it was when I was growing up.
Or if you really want to be old about it, they used to have miniseries, what they called miniseries, best out of 3.
But that's because there were teams that went to, that's because there were teams, this is the mid, late 70s, very early 80s. That's because there were certain teams, the division winners, that got byes to the current conference semifinals. So you can't have even a 5-game series that takes over a week.
Yeah, there you go. And that's exactly right. But at any rate, it's something to talk about, especially when you start hearing quotes from some of the most well-known players in the game who say we really do need to shorten this thing. And again, I think maybe the most well-known and the most outspoken about it is Kobe Bryant. Kobe Bryant said we can't do it. Quote, you can't just lose 5 to 10 games. He's talking about a schedule decrease. While they say that a schedule decrease would reduce injuries and improve quality of play, Kobe said you can't just lose 5 to 10 games. If you're going to do it, you've almost got to go quality versus quantity. If you're going to shorten the schedule, then you've got to shorten the schedule and look to enhance your TV numbers substantially, because now every regular season game is worth a lot more. And that's true. Every game is going to be worth a lot more. It's going to mean a lot more in the standings race, obviously, and just in the opportunity to see the great players play. Fewer games means fewer opportunities on TV, so they're going to have to really kind of drive that revenue that way.
And that's why I threw out the 58 games number, Bob, because that's, take whatever team it is, Cavs, Pistons, doesn't matter. There's 29 teams, not counting yours, so that's, what's 20, so basically that's what you're doing. You're taking 29 times 2, and that gives you 58. That's why I look at that at the floor. And I kind of agree with Kobe on that part of the 70. it almost doesn't do anything if you're going from 82 to 75. If you're going to reduce it, it would have to be, you know, reduced, I think, a little more. And like I said, 58 is what gets you one game in your building against every team, and you go to everybody else's building, you know, just once in that scenario. And let's not forget, I think more current players, even though Kobe just retired, current players are thinking more along the lines of this, or at least publicly I've noticed the last couple of years, and it stems from that last lockout season, the one they had where we had 66 games, and opening day was basically Christmas Day. Scores of players said that they loved that.
Yeah, but like I said before, I mean, you can just wipe that off the table because you're talking about taking 24 games away from every team. You are talking about billions. Never going to happen. Second of all, that kind of a floor would never be considered again, because what's the point of having divisions then? There's no point. If you're just playing everybody once in your building and once in their building, there is no fight against the people in your division. They're never going to play less than three games each against everybody in their division.
Well, I got
then
one
against, then probably an extra one against everybody in your conference, and then maybe only once against the, you know, the guys on the other side. So
well, what's
go
interesting
82.
Too about that, you know, in that scenario, real quick too, you say the divisions won't matter. I think in that scenario, the conferences wouldn't matter, and we know that topic has come up with the disparity in recent years between East and West.
Well, that's just
because
if everybody's
schedules
they don't know how to
equal.
Geographically lay out a conference. That's just because they're ignorant. They could easily fix some of that if they just laid it out better geographically. Seriously, I mean that's one of those.
I agree
really
with that. I doodled
things.
Those things out in the past too, and if I could do it, surely the NBA and Adam Silver. Them good
but,
too.
But yeah, and like I said, so let's be realistic. They're not going to give up that kind of revenue.
Right.
They may give up a little bit of revenue to knock off five or to knock off seven games, and that's not minuscule. You know, seven games to a player who plays roughly 40 minutes a night is 280 minutes of wear and tear that their body doesn't have to go through.
Sure.
Not to mention practices for those games. You know, they're perhaps a little lighter because you've got 3 days in between games now instead of two, or you have very, very few back-to-backs. That's something they could probably work on, having no more back-to-backs to give these guys more rest in between games.
Oh, yeah, a reduced schedule could definitely eliminate that.
There's a lot of things they can do without completely cutting off their own revenue source. I think if they go to, like I said, 75 or even 74 games, you know, knock off eight games, give everybody, every player, like I said, who's a regular, around 320 minutes less per regular season, I think it could go a long way. And as Kobe Bryant said, he had never thought, ever, about shortening the season when he played. He just saw it as something that his NBA idols all went through. Mike did that. Doc played that way. Burrow, I mean, this is the way it was. And he said, I never thought about it until now. Why now? And it's because he said he started to wonder what has happened to the league. How is it that the league is having so many of their stars missing so many games now because guys are getting knocked out, guys are getting injured, guys are having, you know, things happen and then that didn't used to happen. And the question that Bryant is wondering about is things like this. How were John Stockton and Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and those guys able to play so many games and stay healthy? What happened generationally with diet and training, et cetera, being so much better now because nutrition, so much more is known about nutrition, about the body, so many different ways to train? What happened to the point where players are getting more hurt now than they were then? With those guys that he just mentioned. And according to Kobe, he says the answer is more likely than not holistic. He said players playing today are spending years playing AAU basketball before they ever get to the show. Some as young as 8 years old. They play all those games per day during the summer. Then they're in season competition. Most of them are if you're getting to the NBA, most of them are specializing early and dropping their other sports, so they're playing one sport year-round, and when you do, you're beating your body up at that one sport with the same muscle and joint repetition that you know that wears joints and meniscus and cartilage and ligaments down before you even ever reach a professional court. Kobe Bryant said, quote, look, this is all again in the ESPN article today, it's online. And I linked it. As a matter of fact, I tweeted it out. So follow us on Twitter, Sports Radio 106.5, and you'll see it for yourself. Kobe said, looking back, when I grew up, I played soccer until I was about 14. Then when I came back to the States from Italy with his father, when I was 14, that's when AAU was starting to take off, and I literally played basketball all day, every tournament, everywhere, which does nothing but wear the knee cartilage out, which explains why I didn't have any left in 2003. So when asked for solutions, Kobe said, well, it's logistical. Shorten the games, shorten the risk for injury and things of that nature. It will help. And then he said, can we figure something out from a training perspective and a nutrition perspective to protect players and make up for the damages that have been caused from playing basketball all day, every day, from kid until now? I don't know, but that's what they have to try. So really an interesting discussion.
Especially the AAU part, to be honest with you, Bob, you know, because for most who don't know, I mean, we all heard of AAU, especially in a basketball sense, obviously, but I could definitely attest to that, you know, that is absolutely true. It's not like, oh, we got one, you know, our Saturday afternoon AAU game. No, it doesn't work that way. They play multiple games all day, and I can actually
my son is in it. I know.
Yeah.
My son is in AAU. We'll go to tournaments.
Sure.
And we'll sometimes have four games in one day.
And I'm starting
and
to get the messages from an officiating standpoint that they, you know, need some guys. Sorry, guys, I have other things going on right now, so I probably can't make some of those. But I'm getting those notifications, and it's like for an all-day kind of thing.
It exactly is. And like I said, seven or eight over the course of a weekend, for example. And here's the other thing. I know we got to get a break because we're way late. But here's the thing. I'll just wrap with this and then maybe take some calls at 866-240-1065. Get on board of how and let us know how you feel about this. Should the NBA shorten the schedule because of the way these bodies are breaking down today and the stars aren't even available in the playoffs? What did they start many years ago now? Probably close to 20 years ago, I guess. What did they start in Little League Baseball that they didn't have back in the 60s and 70s and 80s? Pitch counts. Back then,
yep,
if you remember, there was only an, because I played it, there was an innings limit, how many innings you could pitch in 1 week, according to the Little League rules, and the idea was to protect pitchers' arms. Of course, that got wiped out quickly because what's an inning? An inning could be three pitches and three ground balls for one guy, and it could be 35 pitches with four walks and three strikeouts,
right,
to another guy. So they started putting pitchers, young pitchers, on pitch counts with the idea. And they also don't let them throw curveballs, which does extraordinary damage early to an elbow on a young, developing, growing kid. So they put these limitations on them at very young ages with the hope, of course, saving their bodies for, if they're good enough, to play at later times in their life, in high school, in college, and God willing, they're able to make the pros. So if baseball can recognize we put an innings limit so that the kids don't ruin their cartilage, their tendons, their muscles, their
right,
this or that, and their arms, why shouldn't other sports kind of consider the same thing? Why is it that a pitcher can be on a pitch count, but a basketball player can't be on a minutes per week restriction so that they're not just destroying their knees, their legs, their everything else, playing the game 24 hours a day, 24/7, but pretty much playing it all day, every day, while they're kids, all the way up through high school and into the NBA. So it's really a fascinating discussion. Let's take a timeout. Want to get you to be a part of that discussion at 866-240-1065. If you'd rather comment on Twitter and Facebook, again, Twitter is Sports Radio 1065, and Facebook is 1065 The Ticket. We'll get you on the air one way or the other right here on the Extravaganza, ESPN 1065 The Ticket.
Be part of the Extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, we roll on at 3:52 on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks so much for being with us. If you want to be with us more personally, you can dial the phone, 866-240-1065. You hear us yapping all the time, all of our opinions on all this stuff. What are yours? That's the way we want to play it. And to that end, we'll go to Aaron, who is in Toledo. Let's talk about shortening the NBA schedule to potentially lengthen the careers of some of the NBA stars who are breaking down at younger ages. Hey, what's going on, Aaron?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I think all professional sports should be, all and kids sports for that matter, should have a day break in between. Look at hockey. They're playing a ton of games. Major League Baseball, you got guys like Cal Ripken Jr. Never going to see those guys again because the amount of abuse these guys are doing now. They're going all out. Well, how many years did Jeter have and he dives into the stands? You know, the sports, everyone's getting bigger and stronger. Yeah, the rules have made it to where it seems like it's a little bit of a ticky-tack league sometimes. But the demand these guys are putting on their bodies by getting such a huge amount of muscle mass on such small frames on some of these guys. You got 300-pound linemen doing, you know, 5-second 40s in the NFL. The demand to be bigger, stronger, faster than everybody else is tearing their bodies down. You got back-to-back games tearing their bodies down even some more. They're not getting the proper rest. I can't function on less than 6 hours of sleep a day. And I don't do anything like what they're doing. You know, I remember growing up playing football, I'm talking fourth, fifth grade, we're doing two-a-days. I play football down in Texas where football is life. Two-a-days in fifth grade is ridiculous. So,
yeah, I would agree.
Like
first of all, to that point, I would agree. Here in Ohio, where football is pretty doggone big, too, and you know, at the youth end at the high school level, two-a-days are forbidden until you get to high school. You can't have doubles until you're at least high school age. But they ended up changing that later on, too. Your point about, if I heard you right, you said you think in all of these sports, they should always have at least one off day between games, even baseball?
Even baseball. Especially baseball. You know, you'd think there's not a whole lot to it. I played baseball and football growing up. You'd think there's not a lot, but, you know, you got the warm-ups. You're throwing every day. You're batting every day. You're putting a lot of strain on your elbows and your shoulders, your hips. You know, it's all going to wear down over time, but it is a different game, though.
I mean, it really is a different game. And I would disagree only because, I mean, think about it. You have 162 games. If you literally did take a day in between each of them, you have an entire calendar year. You have 325 days before playoffs or anything else there that you would take to play it.
Maybe not so many doubleheaders. Or if you're going to do a doubleheader, give a couple of days rest in between a doubleheader.
Well, they don't even have doubleheaders anymore. There's no scheduled doubleheaders. The only ones they have anymore are rainout
doubleheaders,
so they got to make something up. Yeah, they did that. Now that's a change they made. Obviously, 25 years ago, they used to schedule the doubleheaders, the traditional where the
Sunday doubleheader
starts 20 minutes after the end of the final out of the first game. They got rid of those because of the wear and tear on the players' bodies, particularly catchers, but also because also because of revenue. You know, you only got one day's gate instead of two games gate when you had the traditional doubleheader back in the day.
Yeah, some of my favorite memories are going to the Astros games, catching a doubleheader at the Astrodome with the family. Those are great memories. You know, catch two baseball games, take a break in between, have some fun. And with maybe not baseball so much as, you know, back-to-back games, but if they do have back-to-back, try and give them some more time in between or not, because there's so many in the week. I would like to see them do something a little bit less.
Well, I mean, again, I'm not trying to diminish the work or the wear and tear that a baseball player takes, but I mean, to compare it to basketball or hockey or football, where the games are constant motion, whereas in baseball, quite frankly, the only time you're running is if a ball is hit to you, and in between, you're watching pitches and you're standing still, or you're a batter who has hit one and has to start legging it around the bases. That so much of baseball is standing in one spot at the ready for something to happen. Basketball is constant, up and down, up and down. Football
it's
is constant.
Not sprinting back and forth, unless, of course, you're James Harden, you don't have to play defense, but that's something else.
Exactly. So I think baseball can keep doing what they're doing. I don't see any need to shorten that one, but what's crazy to me, and we've talked about this repeatedly in the last couple of years because there's this push by the NFL, again, in an interest to generate more revenue, more game gates. They wanted to expand the season from 16 to 18, which
I would
which
be
is
okay
crazy.
With that. If I'd be okay with that if they cut the preseason.
Well, that's what a lot of people say, but I'll speak to it from the see, now that's a great idea for the fan standpoint, because the fan, especially if you're a season ticket holder, you're paying the same price for those preseason games as you are the regular season games. And if you're going to pay the price, you want to see the whole game, meaning the you know, games that matter rather than the preseason. So for the fans, that's a great idea. Grow the regular season by two games, shrink the preseason by two games. But for the players, it's a terrible idea. And the reason why is, as you know, the starters, the veterans, the guys who you're more worried about wear and tear on, those guys don't play very much in the preseason. They play a series or two in each of the first two games, a little bit more in the third, and not at all in the fourth.
But yeah,
if you
were
to ask them to play two regular season games more, you're really taking, you know, time off of their careers. You're gonna run them into the ground.
And then you get the guys that are trying to come up and prove themselves. They have less games to do so. I mean, you see every preseason game, you got a different quarterback, like the first two or three games.
Yep.
Usually a different quarterback each quarter for the first two games. Then they said, okay, we're going to check out these two for the backup. So game three is usually those two playing like, you know, the last half of the game. And then you have the starter playing the first quarter of the fourth game, if at all. So yeah. it creates the challenge where those guys would have to prove themselves in practice. And again, practice isn't the game setting. So the guys really have to show themselves off. And what do you have? Two quarters to do so?
Yeah, that's
which
a great point.
That's why.
I don't think, you know, as much as we despise the preseason games, they really do need them for the evaluation of players. There's no doubt about it. Draft picks, free agent signees, guys trying to hang on and make another team, make a roster. They need those games. What the owners don't need to do, though, is charge full price for them. If they were,
right, I agree.
They charge full price for them, and they get 20,000 people in a 70,000-seat stadium because nobody wants to pay for those prices. Instead, what they ought to do is charge flat $10 for any seat in the park, any seat in the stadium, $10. Watch and see
first
how
come,
fast people
serve.
Go. For $10, I'll go. And then they'll drink $50 worth of beer and eat $20 worth of hot dogs, and you'll make your money back that way. But the owners are too stupid to see that.
That's exactly right, because they're thinking they're going to lose money off the top when they can make that money in the back end.
Make it up on the back end. That's exactly right, my man. All right, hey, we got to run, Aaron. Thanks for the call.
Love
I appreciate
the show, guys.
It. We are running up against the top of the hour. We're going to shift gears, get into a little baseball talk. The American League Central is tight, first through fourth place, separated only by 3.5 games. The Indians are at the top of all of that. The Tigers are tied at the bottom of it with only that 3.5 games separating them. What's going to happen from this point on? The Indians are on a roll, having won 6 in a row. The Tigers have crept over 500 for the first time in a few weeks. So we're going to talk with Zach Mize, a little AL Central talk coming right up on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Here's the pitch from Happ, swinging a fly ball back in left field, and this ball is gone, a home run for McCann. A three-run shot to left center field into the stands behind the left field bullpen, and the Tigers lead the Blue Jays 3-0 in the second. Here's the pitch from Happ, swing and a fly ball to right field, and this one is off the top of the wall. Upton hangs on. Martinez being waved home for Detroit, and he scores, and the Tigers get another one.
And now
they're saying it's a home run.
Here's
Hardy delivering now, and Tully swings and grounds it to second. It's picked up and thrown to Romine, and the game is over. The Tigers with an 11-0 shutout over the Toronto Blue Jays on this Monday night, and 4 in a row now for Detroit.
Trying to win a season-high 6 straight games, taking on the Mariners. In the fourth, a man on, Jose Ramirez, rips one into left off James Paxton. Carlos Santana trying to score from first. He's in there as Chris Iannetta can't hang on to it. We're tied at one. Now 2-1, bottom half of the fourth. Bauer settling in, strikes out Robinson Cano, then down goes Nelson Cruz. Then with two on and two outs, he strikes out Chris Iannetta to end the frame. In the fifth, the Indians add to their lead. Rajay Davis provides some breathing room. A solo shot, number 6 on the year. 3-1 Cleveland. The Indians go on and win it by a final of 3-1 for a season-high 6th straight win.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We are all over the place this afternoon. Thanks as we begin hour number two right here at 4:09 now on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we are Toledo Sports Leader. Phone lines open at 866-240-1065, but I will ask for your patience as we say good afternoon to a frequent guest of the program and the guy we turn to when we want to talk American League Central baseball, especially when the American League Central is being led by his Cincinnati Reds. I'm looking at a Reds highlight. Yeah, by the Cleveland Indians, who have won, as you heard in the highlight, a season-high 6 straight. And now, as the Royals tumble, of course, 4 of their 5 losses in a row were to the Indians. They've opened up a little 2.5-game lead over the Royals, 3.5 over the Sox and the Tigers in the Central. We speak, of course, of Zach Mizel joining us from Cleveland, not from Seattle, where the Indians are playing late-night baseball out on the West Coast. Zach Mizel covering the Indians and much more for the Northeast Ohio Media Group. Hey, Zach, what's up, bud? How are you?
I'm pretty good, Bob. How's it going?
Not as good as it is for Terry Francona right now. This is now June 6th. We had a little fun on May 6th and started, you know, in that period of time, I guess, not necessarily that date. But, hey, it's early. Nobody knows what they're going to be until they're at least 40 games in. We got to wait till June gets here. Suddenly June is here. And without Michael Brantley, and now without who had been a pretty doggone productive Marlon Byrd, whose career is probably over due to the situation involving PEDs, without a healthy pitching rotation, when you look at what happened to Carlos Carrasco, despite all of that, they're playing their best baseball right now, Zach.
Yeah, we looked at this season and we said there's really two things they have to do early on. Number one, they have to get off to a better start because the last few years they've really hurt themselves and they forced themselves to climb out of a big hole once the summer hits, and they haven't been able to do that. And they've done that. They're 32-24. It's a much better start than they've had the last couple of years, and it's allowed them to finally play from ahead. And now maybe you reach June and July looking to be a buyer instead of a seller for once. And the other thing was they had to play better in the division. They were 32-43 last year against the Central. They had a losing record against all four division opponents. And this year, the only team that's played them well is the Minnesota Twins, who haven't played anybody else well. So it's a little strange. They're 18-7 overall against the Central, just 2-4 against Minnesota. But it's helped them because they know they can beat Detroit now. They're 6-0 against the Tigers. They just swept four games with Kansas City. They've played well against the White Sox. So it's like, if any of those teams are going to pose a threat, it's not as if the Indians can't beat any of them.
That's a very, very good point. Jim and I were just talking about that strange little, you know, a quirk the way things are with the Twins right now. I don't think that will last, obviously, because the Twins are just flat out awful. They have the second worst record in all of baseball. Let's talk about how the things are where they are right now with this first place club. And let's talk about last night. Why not? Trevor Bauer had an outstanding start. He had 10 strikeouts. He seems to have settled into the place where many of us, and you and I talked about this before camp broke, about the rotation and the decisions that were made with Cody Anderson and not Trevor Bauer and Josh Tomlin, too, because Bauer outpitched both of them in the preseason in the Cactus League. Obviously, you can't tell a ton from that because Tomlin is having a fantastic year. But Cody Anderson, of course, has been a disaster. He'll get up and get another start tonight due to the injury situation with Salazar. But, you know, Trevor Bauer felt like, and a lot of people did, that he should have been there all along. And ever since he has been plugged in due to injuries, he has proven that point.
Yeah, it was pretty telling earlier in the season when he was in the bullpen, and he wasn't thrilled with it. I mean, he even said he was very short when he was asked any question, and especially about his new role, and he just kept saying, they tell me when to pitch, and I go pitch. It's clear that he enjoys this role much more. And I think the main thing that's helped him, first of all, it seems to have been a revelation to have Chris Gimenez behind the plate. He's become his personal catcher. He's caught all 8 of his starts this year. And Gimenez isn't catching every day. So in between starts, they're able to watch the game together. They're able to see what a team is doing against a different pitcher the night before, and they can game plan for that. They're on the same page. I thought they called a great game last night. The other thing is he's got this two-seam fastball that he's figured out how to throw against left-handers, and it starts in basically at your rib cage, and it ends up running away. Sometimes he runs it in, and it lands on the inside corner. He had a couple of called third strikes on that last night. Sometimes he'll start it down the middle, and it'll just run so far off the plate you stand no chance. And it's deadly. He's figured it out. I remember in Houston last month, Carlos Correa watched it sail past him 3 straight times for a 3-pitch strikeout. Didn't even offer a swing. So when he's got that working, he's always had a good curveball. He had a good changeup last night. And you saw, I mean, he's pitching the contact early, getting ground balls, conserving the pitch count, and he's a guy who always has gotten stronger as the game goes on. And last night he had 10 strikeouts, and they all came after the third inning. So he got stronger as it went, and he has so many pitches that really the Mariners, even a second, third, fourth time around the lineup, they couldn't figure him out.
We're talking to Zach Meisel, a little Indians baseball. They are in first place. The Tigers are 3.5 back, tied for third essentially with the White Sox, with the Royals splitting them all up. One more thought on Bauer. What was most impressive, I think more impressive than the 10 strikeouts, was the one walk. He seems to be in much more command of his pitches, had better control and command, and there's a difference between those two things, obviously. Throwing the number of pitches he has always bragged about throwing and likes to have available to him. The fact that he goes, you know, as long as he did, 7 2/3 with just one walk, and I think last time out, 7 innings with 3 walks, he's starting to really, and really his entire time that he's been up and starting now, he's got much more control of his arsenal maybe than he did last year or he has since he's been an Indian.
It's all about getting ahead, and he faced 29 batters last night. I want to say he threw a first pitch strike to, it was 18 or 19 of them. He's not falling behind 2-0 and 3-0 like he used to so frequently. And he used to not care about that because he can throw any pitch for a strike, but the problem is he's got a fastball that typically sits 94, 95, and it's really straight. And batters will tell you that if he throws that to you and it's a hitter's count, they're sitting on that, and that's why he's had a propensity to give up home runs in the past. But it's so easy to see that when he does get ahead and he can turn to a number of pitches whenever he wants, he can bounce that curveball in there if he's got you 0-2. He's really, really tough to hit. And I think it took a while for the Indians to convince him that this was the way to approach things. In the past, last year, he led the league in walks, and he said, you know what, I don't really care. It's just a base runner, and I can get out of it. He just didn't want to give in. And I think it took a little time to realize that it's not about giving in. It's about pitching smart and effectively. And when you do get ahead in the count, it makes everything in your repertoire so much more dangerous. So finally, maybe he's bought in. Maybe he's turned the corner. Regardless, even if it's a small sample size, he does look like a better pitcher who has progressed by leaps and bounds.
Is he more open now to talking to you guys? Obviously, as you pointed out, he was very short when he was in the bullpen. He didn't really like it. He made it pretty clear. He just didn't want to talk about it. Is he more comfortable now? And do you think, I don't know where things stand. Carrasco is back. Danny Salazar, maybe you can update us on that shoulder condition. I guess they're calling it a tired shoulder, which is concerning since we're only 2 months in to what could be and should be a long season. So looking at everything, I mean, Bauer's not going anywhere, right, as far as his spot in this rotation.
Yeah, I think he's certainly holding it down. Cody Anderson will make a spot start tonight, and he'll go back to AAA. It's with Bauer, it's always kind of been a case of how he pitches. He's pretty moody. If he pitches well and there's something positive to talk out, he's pretty good. He can talk in depth. If he struggles, if the team loses, he's usually much more short, not interested in talking. So. It kind of depends.
It's just
and
one
a lot
of those
guys
reasons
like
I the reason I asked that, Zach, is I, you know, it's a chicken and the egg question. You know, does his mood and his temperament about where he's pitching and when he's pitching affect his performance, or is it just as you said, his performance dictates his mood and his temperament? Sometimes I feel like with guys like him, you know, they can become their own worst enemy because they get moody or angry or pouty or whatever emotion it is that you get, and that it affects the next start. And obviously, he's rolling right now.
I think he's the same guy when he's on the mound, no matter what.
Okay.
He's certainly, you can tell that he's enjoying what he's doing now a lot more than pitching the ninth inning of a 9-3 game in April. But you can see it. I mean, certain strikeouts now, he's pumping his fist. He had a strikeout last night where he got the third strike, kind of spun around and walked off the mound. You could tell he was pretty proud of himself. I mean, he's been a guy who his confidence, he's always had that mindset of he's better than the batter, and if he does what he's supposed to do, the batter doesn't stand a chance. And so I think that's why he gets so upset and so down if he does fail or if the team does lose when he's out on the mound. And how he acts towards us, a lot of times, you know, a player is, it's been 30 minutes since they lost or sometimes 10 minutes since they lost, and they're not over it, and the emotions are still bubbling over. So I don't always take... You know, you have to take that with a grain of salt. But he's certainly got his spot. I would think he's got it pretty much wrapped up. And I don't think Salazar comes back healthy. Carrasco is back into it. I think Bauer's part of this for the duration here.
As he should be. Now what about Salazar? Sore shoulder. They pushed the start back to Sunday, I guess it is. I mean, or when is his next start? I don't know what the plan is.
Well, so he'll pitch Sunday, barring any further issues. He did say, see, it's weird because his last start was maybe his best of the year. He goes 8 innings. His last pitch of the day, I think, was 98 miles an hour. And he did say, we asked him, you know, you went 8 innings, season high. You only gave up 3 hits. You were still throwing really hard in the eighth. Did you feel good? He threw 113 pitches. And he did say he was tiring the last couple of innings, and that happens. Guys will say that, especially he walked five guys, so it's not like these were effortless innings. But it was a little strange. He had a wrap on his shoulder, which is sometimes common for pitchers, although I think a little less common with him. He usually doesn't have one. But the Indians say it's just a little fatigue, a little tiredness. They want to give him a few extra days. They've done it in the past with guys. I think they did it with him once last year. He didn't end up needing to go on the disabled list. And they hope that's the case again here. I don't think this is some dire situation. A lot of people want to see there's like a shoulder plague going around the Indians clubhouse since Michael Brantley's still out. But I don't think that's the case. They're downplaying it, saying it's not that big of a deal. And they can push him back a few days and give Cody Anderson another shot.
Carrasco gets his second start tomorrow since his return from the DL after that that hamstring. Is he still going to be on a pitch limitation? What was it, 80, I want to say, in his first start? Or where is he as far as his limitations?
Yeah, it was about 80. I don't think they're going to let him get up to 115 or 120, but I think they will take the reins off a little bit. He can probably go about 100 pitches. His arm is strong. It's fresh. It's just a little rusty still. But he was throwing, and he was throwing hard while he was sidelined. It was just a matter of he couldn't really field his position while he was dealing with a strained hamstring.
Offensively, again, you know, they're getting so much more production than I think most people. Jim and I talked about this doing the previews before the season about how, you know, obviously it's about the starting. It's no secret. It's about their starting pitching. Which, by the way, there was another companion piece that I was looking at today on Cleveland.com as I was looking up what you had to say about this club right now. And it's a great point about how much, I don't want to say a push there was, but a lot of folks felt like the Indians needed to part with some of that terrific starting pitching they have in order to get the offense that they needed. They had to go ahead and trade, you know, somebody near the top of that rotation to go and bring a real powerful right-handed bat or whatever the case might be to help with the offense. And now, obviously, paying huge dividends that they didn't do that, and they're getting much more offense than I think a lot of people expected on a relatively consistent basis.
Yeah, it's strange because you look at their offensive numbers and they're third in the American League in runs per game. And then you look at the individual numbers and you see Yan Gomes is hitting 176 with a terrible on-base percentage. You see that Uribe is offered next to nothing. You see that, really outside of Jose Ramirez and maybe Mike Napoli from a power standpoint, and I guess Francisco Lindor, no one has overachieved. Guys are either doing what they should be doing, what they've done, or they're underachieving. And you look at the team statistics and their batting average is about league average. Their on-base percentage is about league average. Their slugging percentage is about league average. And yet they're third in runs. And so that tells me two things. Number one, they've actually been, this is weird to think when you think about some of the players on this team, they've been the best base running team in baseball. They go first to third more than anyone. They go second to home on a single more than anyone. They steal bases at a really high percentage. I think second best in baseball at that. And so they're smart on the bases. They're taking extra bases, and that pays off. We've seen the Royals play that way for the last few years. It's paid dividends for them. And two, they're capitalizing on opportunities. They've been good with a runner on third base in less than two outs. They've hit all right in runners with runners in scoring position. If you take away bases loaded situations, they've been pretty good, and they've been poor in those situations in the last couple of years. So it's interesting because they're overachieving, and they're sure they could absolutely use another bat or two. They need outfield help. I think eventually you're going to reach a point where Jose Ramirez needs to be your everyday third baseman instead of Juan Uribe. And they can be more efficient offensively in terms of personnel. But it's given what they have, who they're missing, and really just the individual performances, they've overachieved. And I think you have to give credit to the front office for sticking on to those starting pitchers and not dealing them, because you're right, they've needed every one of those guys, every guy rumored to be part of a trade, they've needed them, and they're going to need them. And two, I think the hitting coaches, because these guys have been, everyone's called for their firing the last couple of years, and I think rightfully so, but somehow this offense is producing and it's doing enough to win games, and I don't think anyone expected the offense to even be mediocre.
Yeah, I may have given him that. I may have given him mediocre, but it was going to be streaky. You know, it's what it's been for the last couple of years or few years with the Indians, and that's feast or famine. They're either going to get everybody's hitting at the same time, or they're just going to be completely cold and nobody can scratch anything together, especially when Kluber is on the mound. But yeah, it is certainly much better than mediocre. The question is it built for the long haul? Can they do this for four more months? Couple more quick ones on this club, and then I just want to get your thoughts on the Central in general. Again, it's very tightly packed right now, at least the top four are. Brantley, update on him. I guess there was a statement made earlier this week or over the weekend about a setback of sorts for Michael Brantley. How close is he? What is his level of work right now in terms of swings? Is he still hitting off the tee? Is he doing soft toss? Is he driving the baseball yet? What's the status on arguably the best hitter that they have?
Yeah, nothing's really changed with him, which is why the Indians were kind of surprised that information got out that they were really concerned and this took a turn for the worse. They don't know. I think that's the main point here is this is kind of a wait-and-see type of deal. He worked his way back. He got back to the big league club, played in, I think, 11 games, and they thought everything was good. He was responding well, and then he played in 6 out of 7 games, and that's when it was determined he can't handle that right now, and the shoulder's not feeling right. So he went and saw a surgeon, got an injection, and they're basically starting the process all over again. So he's been taking dry swings. He's been hitting off a tee. He's been doing soft toss. He's done about everything except actual batting practice, and that'll come eventually, possibly as soon as this week. But they have to take it slow, and it's they're not going to know exactly when he's ready to come back because he's got to pass every test. He's got to take batting practice a couple days in a row and have the shoulder feel good. And then he's got to go on a minor league rehab assignment, play once, have the shoulder feel good, play 2 games in a row, have the shoulder feel good, play 3-4 games in a row. So it's tough to tell. And the only thing you can do that's different is, I mean, he got the injection. That helped. You're just going to have to be patient and hope that you don't, or make sure that you don't rush him back too soon. Make sure that he's responding well, and at the first sign of that not happening, I think you have to shut him down again and think about your other options. But at this point, it's basically just every day they have to just react to how his shoulder responds and do what it's telling them.
Last thing, Zach, on the Indians, then I want to get your thoughts on the division. I'm going to give you 5 names, and I'm going to ask you what's wrong with this list. Xander Bogaerts, Alcides Escobar, Troy Tulowitzki, Carlos Correa, and Elvis Andrus. What's wrong with that list?
Well, it doesn't include Francisco Lindor, which is a shame. That's the way All-Star voting is these days. It's a popularity contest. It is a little bizarre that a popularity contest that might have Omar Infante and Alcides Escobar, two players having miserable seasons, represent them, counts for home field advantage in the World Series. It's asinine, really. And this isn't to say Lindor just deserves to start at shortstop for the American League, because I think Xander Bogaerts has had the better season. He deserves to be in first, and frankly, I hope he stays in first so that Alcides Escobar doesn't make the team since he's been dreadful for Kansas City. But it's really all about which fan bases are stuffing the ballot box in a particular year. And it used to be the Yankees and Red Sox every year, but they also had players who deserved it most of the time. And now Kansas City and Baltimore and some other teams are stuffing the ballot boxes. And I mean, last week, J.J. Hardy was 5th among shortstops. Francisco Lindor has been out of the top 5 the whole time, and J.J. Hardy's played 22 games. He's been injured. He's been terrible in those 22 games. He's been out of sight, out of mind, except for everyone in Baltimore, and those people in Baltimore have been stuffing the ballot boxes. So it's, you know, it doesn't mean anything really unless you finish first, and Lindor could still get on via the peer vote or the manager vote, but it says something about where the Indians are in terms of a fan base, where the Indians in Major League Baseball are in terms of plastering Lindor's face all over every platform possible to make this kid a superstar and to give him more exposure. But for him not to be in the top 5 is frankly, it's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, it really is. And most importantly, I think it is, as you called it, asinine, because they do make the game count, you know, for home field. So it's a, you know, you would think that they would want a system that is going to put the best players on the field so that if indeed this game does count, best players in the All-Star game, I mean, of course, for home field in the World Series. It's not going to be just played by the most popular players in the cities that do get out there and stuff the box. Lindor, by the way, I read your tweet. He said he doesn't care. It doesn't matter to him at all. He just wants to win. He'd rather play in October rather than playing in a particular game in July, like the All-Star game. And it's a great attitude for a young guy to have. But I really, really hope that voters come around. And as you say, that at least the peers and they get that mishmash or whatever it is of the reserves picked, that Francisco Lindor gets the recognition he's due, because he is a phenomenal. I mean, I was expecting sophomore slump just because, well, history says that's why. You know, he was so good last year, so much better with the bat than anybody ever thought. He was supposed to be all glove, adequate, but very little bat. Instead, he's a tremendous producer. He's done the same thing this year. And I want him to get the recognition he deserves. Last thing, Zach, let's talk about the division. I made the statement yesterday, or no, actually it was on Friday, too. I said, I don't think, because this is back when Kansas City was still in first, there's no way that the Royals, despite their status as the defending champions, and at that time I think they were on a roll, they had won 8 out of 10, they are not, when they played the Indians, I mean, they are not, you know, going to leap out and I think lap the field and open up some sort of double-digit lead in the second half over a second-place team in this division. And obviously they're cold now, having lost 5 in a row, and the Indians are on top. But I said I think it's just going to be nip and tuck. I think all 4 of these teams are built well enough to really make this just kind of 4 teams all within a handful of games of each other between now and trade deadline time, and certainly we'll see what teams do at trade deadline and even all the way to roster expansion time. I think this is going to be one great division race for the rest of the summer. Do you see anybody stretching out and putting distance between themselves and the other 3?
Probably not. I think everybody's flawed. I do think the Indians might be the least flawed of the 4 teams. I look at Kansas City. This is not the same team that won 95 games and won the World Series. I mean, they had Omar Infante batting 5th the other night, and I think his OPS was in 500. So their lineup is much maligned. They've lost a couple guys to injury. Their starting rotation is one of the worst in baseball. And it's not just, you know, it's they used to be able to just get 5 innings out of their starters, turn it over to that bullpen, and that was it. But it's been a struggle because their offense is not quite as good. Their rotation is even worse. They've had injuries to the rotation, too. So it's been a struggle, and I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of hung around the 500 mark the rest of the year. And I look at Chicago. We've seen they're going to go for it. They already got James Shields, so I don't know how much he can add. But, I mean, they started, 23-10, and they've gone 6-18 in their last 24. And they don't have the offense. They've got good top-tier starting pitching, but their bullpen is terrible. And I kind of think they are what they are. They're a streaky team that looks like a 500 team. Detroit is the one team that might have a chance here because they have pitching problems. The bottom of their order is not great. The bullpen is a Detroit bullpen that we've seen for the last few years. But they're going to be aggressive. We know they're going to go out. They're going to add some pieces. And like what we've seen from Michael Fulmer would give you hope that the Tigers' rotation can be better later in the year than it is or was at the start of the year. I think the Tigers will hang around. They're still so explosive offensively.
I was going to say. They can hit their way out of a lot of pitching jams that they may find themselves into.
Exactly. Last night was just the prototypical game where this is what the Tigers can be, and I think they're going to stick around. I think, you know, a lot depends with the Indians on, one, on Michael Brantley, and two, on what they're going to do front office-wise. You would think this is the year where you would want to seize this opportunity because the division is there for the taking. They're not playing catch up for once. They have a relatively very small payroll that's only going to increase the next few years as some of these guys like Kluber, Carrasco, Kipnis, and Gomes and Brantley start earning more money. So this might be the year to add a couple of rentals, bolster that outfield, bolster that bullpen, and really go for it. And you don't have to give up pieces of your starting rotation, which you didn't want to over the offseason. You finally started to draft better the last few years, so you have prospects in the system. I think all of their affiliates are in first place, which is kind of remarkable. But they have prospects to deal, and you can get guys for half a season, and it's not going to cost you an arm or a leg. So if the Indians are aggressive, and I think the front office wants to be, I don't know how badly ownership wants to be, in terms of adding money. But if they do, I think they have to be the slight favorites. Although, again, like you said, there's no reason to just count out any of these four teams yet, because as we've seen, they're all flawed, and it's been a pretty close race so far.
No question about it. Zach Meisel joining us. He covers the Indians and much more for the Northeast Ohio Media Group, Cleveland.com, Cleveland Plain Dealer out there. And, Zach, I can't have anybody on from Cleveland here on ESPN 106.5 The Tig without asking. Game three, where are we? Is this thing over? Do they win game three and turn this thing back into a series? What's your gut telling you after you saw the first two and the 48-point margin of defeat for the Cavs?
Yeah, I think the NBA would be pretty sad if there was a sweep or even a 3-0 deficit in this series. I think the Cavs steal game three. I think it's a good one. Still waiting for Steph Curry to have a Steph Curry game. I think we're still waiting for LeBron to be LeBron. I'll say the Cavs win game three, and I think they don't win again. I think the Warriors win it on their home court this year in five.
Wow. Yeah, and it's hard to argue that. I mean, they really are that much better, as much as we didn't want to believe it. Is the Eastern Conference just as bad now as maybe it looks? Because the Cavaliers just carved right through it at 12-2 to win the East, to get to the finals. And now, of course, you run up against this Western Conference champion and obviously the defending world champion. Is it just that easy to get out of the East, and the Cavaliers are really not as good as perhaps a lot of people thought they were when they mowed down Detroit and Atlanta and Toronto?
I think so. I think there's such a gap between the Cavs and the rest of the East. And I think, you know, the top of the West is so much better than the top of the East. I mean, what the Warriors had to go through. I think Portland's a good team, and they won that series in five games. And obviously the Thunder are a potent threat, and the Spurs are good. I mean, I think the Cavs would have had a better shot against the non-Warriors team, but it still would have been a struggle against San Antonio or Oklahoma City or whoever else. So I do think the East made the Cavs look good. I also think they did. I mean, the Cavs, they couldn't miss from three-point range for, 14 games. So the Cavs did play really well, but the Warriors are just a different animal.
Yeah, no question about it. And they are proving to be everything that they said they were, that a lot of people didn't want to believe they were even from a year ago, when a lot of people put the little, you know, kind of invisible asterisk next to their title saying you didn't have to play the best in your own conference and you didn't even have to play the best that the Cavs had to offer because of injuries. They took that personally. I just talked to a talk show host from San Francisco. They took that personally. It ticked them off, and they are loving the fact that they beat Durant and Westbrook three straight to win that, and now they're doing this to the fully healthy and full-strength Cavaliers. So they're certainly proving their point. Z-Mize, great to hear from you as always, sir. Thanks so much for the baseball analysis. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you again down the line.
Always a pleasure. Sounds good.
All right, there you go. Zach Meisel joining us. He is from Cleveland, of course, and Cleveland.com. The American League Central, I don't think there's any question about it, is going to be a tremendous dogfight the entire way. The champions are no longer the champions that they were, speaking, of course, as he did about the Royals. And maybe, since all of these teams are flawed, maybe it's the team that just has the least number of flaws will emerge. Could that be the Indians? Yeah. Could it be the Tigers? Yeah. Could it be the White Sox? Maybe less so, I think. And, of course, you never count out the Royals. All right, we'll get a timeout now. I've got a few other stories I want to talk about with you before we're done at 5 o'clock and drive time comes your way. Stay right here. As a matter of fact, get more personally here. Dial us up, 866-240-1065. Whether you want to talk baseball, basketball, the story we talked about with shortening the season for the NBA, or any of the others, we'll get you up and on the radio as quickly as we can on ESPN 106.5.
Begin to right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Onward, we roll toward drive time, which is coming your way at 5 o'clock right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket with Mike Miller out today. It'll be Jim Cushlin sitting in, and I know you'll have a good time with Cush. Cush, of course, with us each and every day for the 2 hours of the extravaganza as well, so putting a little bit of overtime. Cush, any reason to disagree at all with Zach Meisel that the Indians might be the least flawed of the four teams in contention in the American League Central?
No, not really. I mean, he laid it out pretty good, I thought. I mean, all the teams have their various, you know, flaws. and it's about who's going to be the last guy left standing. I really agree with his sentiment on the Royals. I remember watching bits and pieces of the four-game sweep the Indians had, and they showed a graphic of just numbers-wise how awful their starting rotation is from a numbers perspective. Their bullpen is still bailing them out, but you can't keep relying on that the way they have the last couple years. I think it's finally starting to catch up to them.
Yeah, no question about it, and it's going to be fun to watch the whole way down. I want to shift gears for just a moment, if I can, to go back to the NBA Finals. We haven't done a lot of Finals talk today. In fact, the only thing we talked about really is with Zach there at the end of the baseball interview, because we just we wanted to take a little bit of a break. Obviously, Game 3 is tomorrow. We'll talk to Rick Nolan tomorrow and see if we can get some insight from him as the series does move from Oakland, California to Cleveland. But I just found this very interesting on the subject of the Finals, without it actually being about the Finals. We have heard in recent weeks and months some of the NBA's old guard kind of calling the Warriors out a little bit, saying, you know what, enjoy all of this stuff, but you know y'all wouldn't be able to do this back in the day. You know Steph ain't hitting 400 threes in a season when we're guarding him and we're allowed to hand check and we're allowed to body him up unlike they are today. You know the Warriors aren't winning 73 games if they're playing the Piston Bad Boys on a regular basis. They're playing the Bulls. They're playing, the old Celtics and Lakers. I mean, y'all get a grip here. Isaiah Thomas has said similar things. Tracy McGrady has said similar things. Oscar Robertson has said similar things. Scottie Pippen says there's no way that team would be better than us. We just swept the Warriors. And a lot of people are just chalking it up to old guy syndrome. Old guys, it was better in my day than it is today. Get off my lawn, you young whippersnappers, all of that kind of thing. Well, does it have any more weight? Does it carry any more weight? Is there any more credence to the critique of the Warriors when the latest barrage comes from the Magic Man himself, Michigan State alum, five-time world champion with the Lakers, Magic Johnson, says his Showtime team would have taken apart Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and the rest of the Golden State Warriors. And what makes this a little bit more interesting, too, is Magic has a kind of a personal connection to this, because former Laker Michael Thompson was on those teams with Magic Johnson. He is the father of Klay Thompson. Klay caught the ear of Magic after Warriors and the Orioles and gave them Warriors. After the Warriors won game 2, 110-77, that 33-point blowout, Klay said, "We're better than the Showtime Lakers." That's what he said, interrupting Draymond Green, who was asked whether the Warriors could be compared to a team from a different era. Klay said, "We're better than the Showtime Lakers." Draymond Green, said, "I think it's all subjective. To say we're better than the Showtime Lakers, how can you say that? We never played them." So how about that? Of all of the people to be the voice of
Reason.
Reason or caution or, you know, moderate humility or modesty or whatever, you don't expect that guy to be Draymond Green.
Yeah, applied resume, you throw those two quotes out, say these are the two names, instead of you, most people would have guessed the reverse on that.
Exactly. But it's not. It's Klay. Now, maybe Klay feels more comfortable doing that because he's talking about his old man. Michael Thompson, again, was a part of two of the five championship teams the Lakers threw out there during Showtime in the 1980s. Michael said, Klay's father, "I admit this, we would shoot, and we shot 8 threes a game. They make 8 threes a quarter." And that's not quite that many, but you get his point. He said, "Golden State would outscore us 50-15 on threes. So how are we supposed to win? So I agree with Klay. I think they would beat us. We couldn't keep up with them offensively because of the way they can score so quickly." In comes Magic, the leader of the Showtime Lakers, the guy who set up James Worthy, Michael Thompson, Kurt Rambis, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Byron Scott, Jamal Wilkes a little in the early part of that decade. This is the guy who set all of those guys up. Magic says, His tweet is, I disagree with Michael Thompson and his son Clay. My Showtime Lakers would beat the Warriors. Magic said today on ESPN, he said, we've never seen two guys who can shoot like Steph and Clay. And I give them that. But they've never run up against somebody like us. I'm telling you, whoever's going to dog me, I'm going to be wearing them down. I'm going to be wearing them out. James Worthy will be wearing them out, wearing them down. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is going to be wearing them out and wearing them down. Clay's dad, this is again all Magic Johnson talking. Clay's dad, Michael Thompson, is one of the smartest players I've ever played with in all of basketball. But the Warriors would have had bad matchups against us. There's no way they're going to deal with Kareem. There's no way they're going to deal with James Worthy. The thing that we could do that would affect them and cause some problems is that we could set up and we could run them on the fast break. I'm a man. Hold on. That's the end of Magic Johnson right there. I want to pause there and just offer this editorial. Magic Johnson is spot on. Could you imagine Andrew Bogut being asked to defend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and the Skyhook?
Yeah, he won't be going off for six blocks like he did in game two, I'll tell you that much right now.
Forget about it. My goodness, he would never get a shot off on offense with Kareem standing over him. There aren't centers like that anymore. James Worthy would be the guy that Draymond Green would have to try to chase around. James Worthy was one of the best inside-outside slashing but great mid-range jump shot hitting players of his or any other era. Byron Scott could shoot probably... If Byron were in his prime today and took threes as often as Steph and Clay take them, which, of course, back then you just didn't do. But
yeah, that analogy of eight threes in a game versus eight threes in a quarter, that is still kind of true. In the 80s, even though they instituted in the very early 80s, nobody shot them all that much.
Well, and also the line was deeper then, too,
true.
When they started out. You know, they played with the distance over the course of the last 30 years. But Byron Scott was such an unbelievable shooter. I believe if he played today and trained on that shot, the way Clay trains on that shot and Steph trains on that shot, he would be every bit as good. Well, I'll say every bit, but he would be a phenomenal threat. So, and then of course there's Magic. Who is going to defend the 6'9", 230-pound Magic Johnson, who was very, very different than the 6'9", 260-pound LeBron James, because Magic was a true point guard and an absolute nightmare who could play the post much better than LeBron can play it, and he would take little Steph Curry, if that's who it was, down low and destroy him, and he would take Klay Thompson. He'd still be bigger than Klay Thompson if that's what he had to do. Nobody was going to guard Magic. Nobody was going to guard Kareem. Forget about it. It's just not happening. People need to recognize that when something is great today, it doesn't make it all-time great the way so many people want to do it. You know, people want to crown, yeah, that season by Cam Newton was the greatest season any quarterback ever had, because it just happened. You know, Steph Curry is the greatest shooter anybody has ever seen. Well, he might be with the 400 threes that he made, but I would again point out nobody in the 1970s, including some of the greatest shooters the world will ever see, trained on three-pointers to the point where they're shooting 1,000 of them a day and perfecting that shot. It just wasn't part of the game plan. It's different today. Could any of them, if they worked it as well as and as much and as often as Steph has, be as consistent as him? Entirely possible. Not probable, but entirely possible. So I just think this stuff about everything today, because it's new and fresh and in front of our eyes, is the greatest thing ever, is something that really should stop.
And then, of course,
and I'm glad to hear Magic standing up for those Showtime Lakers. Go ahead.
And then, of course, with everything you're saying all being true, you didn't even mention the other part, which is fine, because it's one of the main parts to, I think, this as well, is the various rule changes over the years.
Exactly. And that's what we talked about before, that Scottie Pippen talked about.
Yep. That's
and then Isaiah
right.
Thomas talked about.
And Isaiah really especially brought up, because especially Isaiah, because you think of the prism of the bad boy Pistons, you can't play like that anymore.
No, you can't. And you know what? And Isaiah, I mean, forget about that part of it. Look at what Isaiah went through to do what he did. He got the crap kicked out of him.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, hand checks, every drive to the basket was an adventure in being banged around on stuff that would never be called then, but would, of course, would be protected like they're made of glass today. Isaiah was right. Not just the way the Pistons and other teams played defense then, but you can see how great Isaiah was against those other defenses. I'm really trying not to be a hater, and I'm not being a hater on the Warriors just because they're kicking the Cavaliers' A's, okay? I'm really not. I'm being legit here. I'm listening to Magic. I'm listening to Pippen. I'm listening to McGrady and some of these other guys. They are right. This game that the Warriors are playing today is nearly a different sport. Nearly. The style, the rules, the training to shoot threes, it's almost a different sport. And I don't think they could go back and play the sport the way it was played for all of those times, especially as they're talking junk about the Showtime Lakers in the 80s, and play their sport and beat them. Michael Thompson, one last thought. Michael Thompson, father of Clay, said, I'm a man securing my legacy and in securing my accomplishments. I don't have to be all, oh, we're better than them. I'm not that grumpy old man, even though I might sound like it many a time. But I can't admit when a new era is better than something else or that's changed from the time I played. And the way they play, we would have a hard time keeping up because, like I said, our game wasn't shooting threes, which theirs are. Three beats two. I get it, Michael. Proud papa. You know what? How could you not be? All NBA son, Klay Thompson, one of the best two-way players in the game, one of the best shooters in the game, Steph Curry, the MVP, proud of your boy and his team. I get it. I'm fine with that. But when you take that personal narrative away and you look at it objectively as somebody without a kid on this team, Magic Johnson is right. Magic Johnson is right. They'd never be able to deal with Kareem. They wouldn't be able to deal with Worthy, and good God, what Magic Johnson would have done to anybody that tried to check him. That is crazy. All right, that's it. I had to get that story out there. Didn't get a time for a lot of the other stories we wanted to get to, but the good news is we'll be back about 22 hours from right now to do this all over again tomorrow afternoon at 3 for the next extravaganza. As for you, stay where you are because Drive Time is coming up next. Cushland in for Miller right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Have a good one.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.